This is Theory of Change. I'm Matthew Sheffield.
Thanks for joining me for another episode. Got a great program for you today, but I did, before we get into it, want to mention that Theory of Change is part of the Flux Media Network. So go to flux.community for more articles and podcasts about politics, religion, media, and society and how they all intersect. And if you like this program, you can just go to theoryofchange.show to get the full archives with the video, audio, and transcript of every episode. And if you're a paid subscriber, you have unlimited access. You can do that on either Patreon or Substack. So thank you very much to my paid subscribers. You guys are making this possible. All right, so with that little plug out of the way, the mandatory plug, thank you, let's get into the program. It's all but official that the 2024 presidential election is going to be Joe Biden versus Donald Trump. And so because of that, we're now going to move to more of a general election focus on this program. And of course, that is what the general political media is as well. At this point, in many of the surveys, Joe Biden is trailing Donald Trump, and there are a number of reasons for that. And one of them is because the Democratic Party is operating under a politics of yesteryear, operating under strategies for a Republican Party that has not existed in many decades. And as such, they are unable and even unaware that the Republican Party has set up a gigantic infrastructure both for professional networking, career advancement, legislation composition, and also propaganda. And as such, the Democratic Party is at a significant institutional disadvantage. As much as Democrats often talk about how democracy is at risk in this country, and indeed it is, they have not functionally change their behavior from an institutional standpoint. And we will talk about that today with the guest in today's episode. And so joining me today to talk about all of this stuff is Rachel Bitticoffer. She is a political strategist, and she is the author of a new book called Hit 'em Where It Hurts. And we will get more into that. So welcome to Theory of Change, Rachel.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here today.
Yeah. So let's, I guess, start off the discussion with what's the elevator pitch behind your book here?
Yeah, just contextually, I think it's important for people to understand, in this audience probably in particular, this book is the product of a mission to bring the rest of the world up to what political science knows about voting behavior, the mass electorate, voter psychology, political polarization, because the reason that I'm even sitting here today is a forecast using my academic work. I was a PhD, I was a professor at a university in 2018 that forecasted a really large Democrat, a really strong Democratic performance in the 2018 midterms. And the reason I even put it out was I was frustrated watching and reading things like 538 and the Cook Political Report and others that didn't seem to incorporate modern or recent political science literature, especially the literature on political polarization, because you guys hear the word all the time, we're polarized, it's polarizing, whatever. But what people don't know is that actually that has created a really distinct mass electorate that never existed. I mean, maybe back in the Civil War, we don't have polling. It's never existed before. And it has conditioned behavior in a different way than what was happening in the 90s or when Ronald Reagan won and won almost every state on the map, right? Those are things that can't happen now because we have a different electorate. So motivating the book was to get the left predominantly to understand the reality of the American electorate, the role that partisanship, party identification plays in vote choice, and then the very, very rough clay that is the American voter. The American voter is not like the people who are watching us now. They are tuned out. They are mostly not interested in politics. And if you think about something that you're not interested in, like, say, NASCAR, I don't know anything about NASCAR. I couldn't tell you one NASCAR driver. But if I was into NASCAR, I would know a lot about it. I would be able to tell you a whole bunch, right? So people don't have an interest in politics. That's the reason why half of the eligible electorate, basically, it's about 40% in 2020, don't even bother to vote in the most consequential of our elections, the presidential election. People in America are very tuned out, and that has gotten much worse in the modern media environment, which allows people to completely isolate themselves from political news and current events and really just go all in on entertainment, right? So
there's just so much of it.
Oh, so much. It's so much, right? Like I can't, sometimes I go into Netflix and I'm like, okay, what should I watch? Okay, too much. I quit.
Yeah. Right? I mean, hell, like if you wanted to, you could literally only watch Real Housewives shows.
You literally can
do that for a year.
And that's the thing is like people do that, right? So like we on the left though, our system is built and based on a flawed foundation. So this book is first getting you to understand how that assumption that the electorate is engaged and informed and the public knows all this stuff that's happening with Donald Trump, it's a flawed assumption, okay? Mm-hmm. And if you accept that the electorate knows almost nothing about what's happening in contemporary politics, strategically you shift, right? And it becomes, then we need a messaging strategy that informs the electorate that they're facing an existential threat to their health, wealth, safety, and freedom, right? So getting that second part of the book is about getting people to learn how the Republican system operates, how they've developed and institutionalized infrastructure to pull off they have really strong electoral performance relative to the amount of people that there are in the Republican Party. And they've used it to dominate, right? And so the book is about getting people to understand Republicans don't campaign the same way. Their election messaging isn't, hey, I have candidate Tim Ryan, and he's a bipartisan moderate who's going to get things done. He was
up against good ideas.
An extremist in J.D. Vance, and J.D. Vance won that election. Now, there is a lean to the right in Ohio, but at the end of the day, the voters that voted for J.D. Vance on that partisan label preference, the R on the ballot next to him, many of them, they had no idea they were voting for a fascist, a guy who's actually espoused in the public record, very fascist views, especially about women, okay? They never heard that he would vote to ban abortion nationally. They never heard any of this because our campaigns do not define our opponent. And so that's what this book is about, getting everybody out of the old strategy, understanding how modern elections work and how polarization has really elevated the effect of partisan label. And at the end of the day, if partisanship is going to predict the vote choice for 90% of voters, and it does, even those independent leaners, then you have to be designing a campaign that sells the entire brand. And that's what the Republicans have been very good at. Their brand good, our brand bad, right? And so it's a whole new approach to electioneering on the left.
Yeah, well, and when you're talking about defining the opposition, the Republicans figured out a long time ago, and probably I'd say Paul Weyrich, the right-wing Christian strategist, he was the first one that really figured this out, where he said that it's easier to motivate them against something than for something. That's right. There is so much political science that has really just floated around within the academic community. And I mean, that was my major in college. And I remember reading all these papers, and then I would look at the way that the two parties behaved. And I was on the right at this point in time. And I was like, wow, the Democrats, even though they all have these liberal professors, don't pay attention to them at all and what they say. And like one of the key insights of political science is that advertising doesn't work, especially at the higher you go in politics, the less it works in terms of persuasion, because people already know who Donald Trump is. They already know who Joe Biden is. They already know who Barack Obama is, or whoever, Hillary Clinton. They have their opinion. It's the same way that if you like Pepsi and I show you 1,000 ads for Coke, it's not going to make you go buy a Coke.
Yes, like, and it's because of the.
It's not going to make you like it, especially.
Right. Yeah, and really, it's not like about the person. So it's not Biden. I mean, Trump's different, okay, but whatever. It's not Bush and Kerry or whatever. Yeah. It's the in American political science, when the field of mine is behavioral, right? When that field emerged, it was because we had finally invented surveys on telephone surveys, and people like me, nerds, political scientists were like, hey, now we can find out things about the American electorate. And so what they endeavored to do was go find out about the electorate. It's a seminal work in my discipline called The American Voter. And what it found, folks, was that Americans don't know jack shit about politics. Okay? They can tell you who the president is, maybe the vice president. Beyond that, most Americans don't have much context to work with when it comes to interpreting political phenomena. But the political scientists who wrote this book argue, don't worry about it, because they have this handy cognitive shortcut that they can use to make informed political decisions that don't require them to have all this information. What is that shortcut? It's the party label. Okay. And partisan electorates, no matter how much you bleach out the party part in the campaigning, which is bad for us, right? At the end of the day, the voter is getting into the ballot booth. And if I know nothing, I mean, say you were sitting there right now, Matthew, but you were a black dot. I didn't know if you were a man or a woman, if you were rich or poor, old, young, suburbanite, rural, nothing. But I knew that you were an independent who said, I lean to the Republican Party or a Republican, vice versa on the other side, I would be able to predict your vote choice a year away from an election, a year away, as I have done in two cycles, right? I'll be able to predict your vote choice 9 out of 10 times. I'll be right. 9 out of 10 yeah. times, because that you're not buying a candidate, you're buying a party.
Yeah. And to some degree, we're kind of seeing that people not understanding that with when you look at a lot of the discussion about public opinion polls and Joe Biden and Donald Trump, that like, I think the number one thing that happened in the Republican presidential primaries this year is that it wasn't a real primary, and that essentially because all the candidates were too afraid to attack Trump, basically it was a coronation of you should vote for Trump because Joe Biden is the devil incarnate. Republicans, and you need to understand that. And that was the message out of every single debate.
Yep.
Joe Biden is evil. That was it. It was never, well, Donald Trump is kind of dumb, or he's kind of corrupt, or is extreme, even though except for Chris Christie, he was the only one that was actually willing to criticize Trump. And it was like the same, they made the exact same mistake, the non-Trump candidates that they made in 2016.
Because yeah. Huh?
They were too afraid to criticize this guy. And if you don't criticize the number one person, well, you're not going to win.
Why would I pick a Trump alternative if I can have Trump, right? I mean, like, you're not going to...
If you didn't tell me why Trump was bad.
Exactly, yeah. Right? And as you point out, Christie did it. Now, if they had all done it, I am convinced they could have put this guy down, okay? But it would have taken all of them, right? And they are so... They're like, it's like, I don't know. They're so they've turned themselves into such hapless lumps of clay, right? They can't even figure out how to get out of a wet paper sack anymore.
Yeah. And I think the reason for that is that the Republican Party is not actually conservative. Right.
That's exactly
it's reactionary. Right. It is not a conservative party. And in many ways, the Democratic Party actually is the conservative party in America.
Yes.
Sad to say.
If you define classical conservatism, which you and I both, I think, understand pretty well. Yes. I mean, honestly, the Democratic Party is trying to preserve our institutions. And that's a classic neoclassic liberalism, right? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, and certainly not trying to socialize anything. And something that was, and of course, like somebody who's right wing hearing us say that might say, that's just a bunch of communists talking nonsense. I don't have to believe that. But something that is an objective fact to this point is that when American political consultants who are Democrats will go and work for the British Conservative Party because they see it as not that different from the Democratic Party.
Exactly, in a lot of right. ways. It's
amazing, no so, right? Over because here.
When I do, I did a survey once to test this, and I because I had a wonderful 5-year run where I had my own survey research center. It was fantastic. Things came into my mind, I could test it. When I tested like brand, like awareness, like what comes to mind when you think of each of the party's brands, right? And guess what? I mean, you won't be surprised at all when I tell you what the most common word was that people popped out in terms of hearing of what do you think of the Democrats, right? And it was socialism. So let's think about how Republicans do their swing messaging, okay? It's about branding us as socialist and more lately child pedophiles. And what it is like, okay, so a Democrat's like, well, you can't call people a fascist. They don't know what it is. Well, nobody knows what a socialist is either, right? It's not that voters know that like we're socialist because there's a bunch of policy points that prove it out. They just keep hearing the association, the word association. And the way that we run, like Tim Ryan did in Ohio, I mean, we did kind of a bifurcated strategic map in 22, where Michigan and Arizona ran against the Republican Party and defined it as an extremist movement. And then the old strategy ran with people like Tim Ryan. What Tim Ryan's apologetic Democratic approach is this: the Republican opponent saying, don't vote for Tim Ryan because he's a Democrat and all Democrats are socialists. Okay. And Tim Ryan's message is, yeah, but I'm not one of those Democrats. And what you hear if you're a swing voter is, boy, there's something really wrong with the brand Democrat. And if you're walking into a ballot booth where the most important thing on the ballot is going to be the D and the R and brand association and basically top of mind awareness of impression, then it's very dangerous and bad to be telling swing voters, yes, there's something wrong with that brand. You have to elevate your own party brand, because at the end of the day, it's the perception of the Democratic brand on the ballot is going to predict your performance in a swing race, and especially against an opposition that's willing to make. I mean, think about it. We're living in a country, folks. We're living in a country, the only advanced democracy, that doesn't even have paid maternity leave. Okay. Everywhere else, they have paid 6 weeks or whatever of maternity, maybe 6 months in some cases. Here, I was back to work 5 days after a C-section, okay? No paid maternity leave. So we're not anywhere close to a communist regime. We can't even see communists from our backyard, okay, in this country. And yet, a not insignificant part of the population, I would argue probably about 50 million Americans, think that we're socialist.
Yeah, well, and it is, I mean, and a lot of that is media effects. Yeah. And as a discipline in political science, there's a massive, massive archive of studies that show that media affects people's opinions.
Yeah.
And yet, when you look at the way that Democratic leaders think about media, they seem to have the idea, and this is to the antiquated belief systems that you've been talking about, is that they seem to have this idea that, well, somebody can hear 24/7 on 6 different right-wing cable channels and countless YouTube channels that Democrats are socialist pedophiles who are going to let China take over America.
Yeah.
They can hear that every single day of their lives. But then if we have $100 million of ads on shows that they don't watch for politics, that will counteract it.
No.
And it's like, no, guys, that's not how it works. But yet,
it works.
Yeah. But this, it's so pervasive, this idea that advertising is a panacea. Let's talk about, why do you think that is?
I mean, I think there's a real naivety about how media operates and how the Republican Party operates in relationship to the media. I mean, Democrats don't, it was like me for 5-6 years now teaching people, actually public opinion flows from the top down, right? The reason people are going to start noticing the economy is doing better finally is because the media is finally giving them headlines about how good the economy is. You can have things that are external, like Gaza support from the Palestine people. But most of the time, media effects are shaping public perception, right? And even once you recognize that, then you have real logistic hurdles to implementing something like they have, where they, as you pointed out, all day long, if I'm a conservative, I'm going to consume various conservative media, but it's all going to be the same message over and over, and repetition is what you need to make it sink in. Whereas like us, we're going to talk about 400 different things. There's no repetition. One show is focused on this, one show is focused on that. And we're not going to be able to compete with that. But what we can do, because media follows campaigns, is if we're shaping our message to create a narrative then, and if we run it from all levels, state legislative, House, Senate, Gov, President, it can make a cacophony effect, like the Republican Party just did in 2021 with CRT. CRT is something even I, and I know almost everything, had never heard of in early 2021. And yet they took something I had never heard of and made it a household name, a national name, and made an entire election cycle revolve around it. How did they do that? Strategy and centralization. We can't stumble our way into better communication. We have to strategically design that system and intentionally centralize things. So that's a lot of the work that I'm working on now.
Yeah, no, it's true. And of course, the way that they're able to do that is that they have, and I can say this as somebody who was on the political right, that the right wing spends probably in a given year at least $500 million on networking, like networking organizations, internal networking. And so they've got these groups like the Council for National Policy, Americans for Tax Reform, CPAC, and Charlie Kirk's many, many organizations, which just alone, he controls like $100 million.
That's right, exactly right. You're the only person I've ever met that knows that other than me.
That's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate. I mean, like I lay out in the book, I'm like, look, this is what they do. Like we should stop telling rich people we don't want their money. We need billionaires, and they have to start spending billions on building this infrastructure,
an infrastructure of democracy.
Yes, infrastructure for democracy. And we have 500 grassroots groups for youth voting, all elbow grease, okay, and spit. And there's almost no one's paid to run or work in any of these things. And they have Turning Point. They have $100 million, four office buildings of four floors each, because I went and debated Charlie Kirk so I could see the infrastructure of Turning Point. One of those buildings I didn't access is outside labeled the Turning Point Logistics Center. So four floors devoted to logistics, guys. And like, we're just getting like, we cannot band-aid our way through this. We have to have an infrastructure that's heavily invested in. We have to start right now because we're already 15, 20, 30 years behind in that, depending on what institution you're talking about. And at the end of the day, we for years have been saying, oh, they have all this stuff and why don't we have any stuff? Well, okay, then fucking build it, right? Like, it's time to build it, dude. How many years are going to go by when you were like, oh, we wish we had an ALEC? Like, you have to find these donors and have conversations about how to better spend their investment money in elections. Because as you just pointed out, $100 million in September isn't going to offset 10 months of narrative setting by right-wing media.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I think, and this is something that I've talked about a lot on my show, is that I think that the reason why you don't see this stuff taken seriously is that when they look at a Democratic large donor or a party leader or high level consultant, when they look at Ben Shapiro or they look at Charlie Kirk, they see a buffoon who says constantly says stupid stuff. And you know what? They are that. But they also are heard by tens of millions of people every single week when they say these things. And so you can laugh at what they have to say, and it is absurd. And like, I have a comedy news podcast, so we do laugh at it. It's worth laughing at it. But the problem is that things that are like fascism is both absurd and dangerous.
Yes.
And if you only think that it's absurd, then you're going to lose to it.
Yes. Exactly. I mean, I'm doing a project that's called Project 1933. It's tied into my work trying to get people to read the Heritage Foundation's Manual for Leadership, which is reissued since 1980 every time there could be a new incoming Republican administration. I thought, could these people have possibly put 1,000 pages of a fascist autocracy takeover plan into the Heritage Manual? And I ordered it. And guess what? they did, because they know we're so inept, they can write their shit right out in public. And it describes how they're going to use Schedule F, how they're going to take over the civil service, how they're going to ignore the court rulings. It's a pathway to fascism, a transition to fascism. And I'm trying to get people to see what happened in Germany in 1933. Hitler is sworn in on Jan 30th. And it's basically like the Trump swear in, right? Like, oh, this guy's going to be a hot mess. This government will last 3 weeks. The conservatives are going to rein him in, this and that, this and that. And I'm not kidding. By the summer, DACO is built and it's filled full of the Nazi party's political enemies, guys. 3 months, dude. It didn't take long. So I'm like documenting it in real time, like it's a live tweet. Tomorrow, in fact, is the next segment of that, where I'm trying to show people just how quick it is, because all you need is a willingness to ignore the law, to suspend the law, to say the law is suspended, and you are not going to ever sell me that this Republican Party, given Elise Stefanik was just on CNN talking about how she would have overthrown the government for Donald Trump on January 6th. We have to believe them. They are quite serious. They are going to establish a fascist autocracy, and we have to panic now, because if we wait till they're actually doing it, it, like in Hitler's Germany, it will be too late.
Exactly right. And I think on the Hitler point, one of the other things about him is that people looking at him today, almost 100 years from when he first came along, they tend to think of him as just this purely evil and charismatic figure who was sort of had an almost godlike competence of dictatorship. But that's actually not how things were. Like, before he became the absolute ruler, people thought of him as an idiot.
Yes.
As a stupid moron who was constantly putting his foot in his mouth. And guess who that reminds you of?
Yes.
Donald Trump.
Yes. I keep trying to tell people, listen, don't compare Hitler to Trump to Hitler from 1944. Okay. Like after he's murdered 6 million Jews in the gas chambers, what you should be looking at is the comparisons from 1932, 1933 Hitler. And if you do that, you'll see the way the Nazis did their stuff was a victimization narrative. It was grievance politics, and it was an us versus them propaganda psych ops that they utilized a new mass communication tool to execute. That was the radio. Never before could you beam a voice into a head of an American in their living room prior to that. And it was really instrumental in what the Nazis ended up doing. We're in a very same situation, because the invention of the internet has completely and fundamentally changed how people are getting information. And we learn that because we know now that there's a segment of the Democrats' base, right, that has been radicalized over Gaza, probably by social media content through TikTok and other things that were financed by Iran. Okay. We've never had a capability for foreign governments to put content into American brains directly. It's a new form of thing. And Vladimir Putin used it to first elect Trump, help get Trump elected. And now it's being turned against us both domestically and internationally. So we're really in a moment. Yes, there are differences. The United States is a stabilized, institutionalized democracy that's been in operation for almost 250 years. The Weimar Republic in Germany was never stable. Okay. So that is true, folks. But at the end of the day, when you look at the mechanics of what happened, if the ruler is willing to say there is a crisis at the border is being invaded, I am suspending the Constitution, that's it. It's game over. Now, you might say, well, won't we all react? Maybe. But it's really easy to say that you will when you're not the one with the AR-15 pointed at your family, right? So maybe we'll react. But if they've declared martial law and they're shooting protesters in the streets, it's not going to be sufficient. The time to stop it is before it happens.
Yeah. And we know for a fact that when Trump was trying to illegally cling to power in 2021, he was receiving advice from people you need to suspend the Constitution.
Yes.
You need to seize the voting machines. You need to declare a martial law because there is an insurrection.
And like, we know
they
we
were the ones talking about insurrection.
First. Yeah, and we know this too, that was a White House meeting late at night after the chief of staff had left, because Cassidy Hutchinson told us, right? And it came within seconds, folks. And then actually it happened. Trump said, you know what, I can do whatever I want, right? I can appoint Sidney Powell as a special prosecutor and let her see, right? And they're like, yeah, you can do that, but we're not going to do it. No one's going to execute this for you. No one's going to, like, he tried to appoint her, but the rest of the room was like, no, we're not going to do it. They literally ignored a presidential order. People have no idea of any of that. Like, my friends that vote regularly even, so they're already better than most people, they don't know anything about what happened. They know there was an insurrection thing at the Capitol. They don't realize it was part of an intricate, multi-level, multi-pronged, party-wide conspiracy that came this close to ending democracy. And that's why they've devised Project 2025. They're actually taking applications from young conservatives who they're going to ideologically screen. They're going to have this whole data bank of pre-screened people who were like you, right? That are committed to loyalty to not to the Constitution, not to anything else, but to Donald Trump personally. And I mean, that's just where we're at.
Yeah, it is. And so all those people that refuse Trump in 2021, if he wins, no one like that will be allowed in.
Donald Trump's going to like pick a vice president that helps him do something. Like, he picked Pence because he wanted to make sure the evangelical vote, the most important constituency in the Republican Party, was squarely behind him. And he's a hot mess personally. And we thought maybe they would care because they're supposed to like be religious, but apparently not. Like that, he's not doing that this time. Trump has one criteria for Veep.
Obedience.
Will this person do what I want them to do when I seize power? And that's it. Okay. And that's why Elise Stefanik was auditioning on CNN the other day.
Yeah, no, exactly. And of course, they also do this at the sort of thing at the local and state levels as well. And you mentioned a group that I think a lot of people might not have heard of called ALEC. What is ALEC for people who don't know what that is?
Republican infrastructure.
What do they do? Yeah.
Yeah. Within the Republican massive infrastructure, which is, as he pointed out, at least $500 million a year, but probably significantly more if we could actually.
Well, if you include the media, it's over billions.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, one of the things that they did when they were developing a plan called Red Map, which is what they used to gerrymander, they had good timing. They had Michael Steele's strategy. Fire Pelosi, nationalized politics, a referendum on Obama and Obamacare, seized in 2010, and they ended up having this great electoral performance right at the right moment because that was a redistricting year. And they used that power to redistrict themselves a ton of state legislative seats. At the same time, what they were doing was building something called the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, A-L-E-C. And what that does is it streamlines legislation for the state level. So when you look at Florida, right, we all know they have a thing called the Stand Your Ground law, because we all know Trayvon Martin was brutally murdered for no reason because of the Stand Your Ground law. What people don't realize is Stand Your Ground is a law that's in multiple states, and it came out of this think tank called ALEC, which writes what we call model legislation. So they basically take a law, they write it up, it's always crazy shit, like trans bans or Stand Your Ground or busting the unions or whatever it is, right to work, that all comes from ALEC. And then they introduce it all across all the state legislatures that they control in the same legislative cycle. And that's how you can get somewhere where, like, Ron DeSantis starts ranting about trans people, and within 6 months, every state legislature that's controlled by Republicans have passed brutal anti-trans legislation. It's because it's all centralized. It's all coming out of ALEC. And we have absolutely nothing like that.
And I think it's really, that network is so important because it allows them to move with extreme quickness to impose their agenda on states and localities. So, like, and you saw that, for instance, certainly with various anti-CRT laws, various book censorship laws, teacher censorship laws, and they just rolled these out before anybody in the local communities had any idea what the hell was going on. And like, and they rolled the local media as well, because they would give these signs to their protesters and they'd show up somewhere and at a school board and say, I'm concerned about this or that. And these were in many cases, professional right-wing activists, not parents at the school, no connection at all to the area. And the local media had no idea that this was happening and who was doing this. And they didn't ask anybody. And so they would just report it as, here's some concerned parents who were talking about schools. And they fooled a lot of people. And it's only now that they have caused so much censorship and so many and suppressed so much free speech that people are now realizing, oh, I actually have to pay attention to my school board election. So lunatics who want to impose Christo-fascism, don't take over my school board.
I mean, I don't know if you saw this, but just yesterday, one of these Moms for Liberty school board nuts, right? It was a man, but whatever. That's the group that's promoting Christo-fascism on our school boards. He accused a Utah student, a minor child, of being transgender. She is not. And now she's in police custody because so many people came after her that this poor innocent random kid. I mean, what is that, right? Imagine if that was your kid. Like how angry would you be that some dude on a school board set radical extremist to the point where you have to put your kid into protective custody? Right? Like we have to make sure that we're communicating to people the stakes, because although we are disorganized, disinterested, and not motivated, they're few in number, but they are all of those things. And they also are very strategic. I lay it out in the book, how they made CRT a household name using not only right-wing media ecosystem, which is one part, but by getting our mainstream system to validate the crazy stuff that they want to talk about. Okay. And we see that last night too, with her report for Joe Biden. They've been pounding this narrative, trying to paint him as senile. And now they've got this great report that they can point to. It's none of it is an accident, guys. Like, it's all intentional. And I was reading a book from another ex-conservative activist was talking about, hey, everything that I was indoctrinated with, I thought like the left had all this stuff that was like similar to the stuff on the right, all this strategic infrastructure with long-term plans and goals that were rolling out step by step, radical plans. And then she gets out of the conservative movement into the other side and realizes, okay, no, actually there's no liberal conspiracy there because there's nobody's doing it.
And there isn't even a liberal media.
No, like, right. There's just a media that has been like since the 60s, We changed the model for media in America so that it had to turn a profit. It used to be that the networks, and keep in mind, we're talking about a very different environment. So it was CBS, NBC, ABC, basically at the beginning. Those networks, in order to use the public airwaves, had to air public affairs programming as a public service, the news, things like that. Even though those things were not very profitable or didn't turn a profit, it was kind of the cost of doing business to access the American mind for entertainment and make money. Okay. After we move away from that model, suddenly the newsroom is faced with a problem. The corporate owner of the media station is saying, hey, we need you to be profitable. We're not going to operate you at a loss. And once that happens, they have to meet what people want psychologically. And people don't want hard news, dense stuff, serious conversation. We're conditioned, we're human beings, and we're conditioned for certain things. And at the end of the day, if you are operating a news station with a mandate to maintain a profit margin, you're going to give people what they want, not what they need. So we stopped eating our civic vegetables a very long time ago. And now we're really harvesting, the ice we're harvesting now was planted back then in the 80s and 90s.
Yeah, no, it's true. And we're seeing this on so many ways when it comes to different issues, like, and I think most principally currently with the economy, that you have, it's just amazing to me how ignorant economists are about media studies. They know literally nothing about it. And they don't understand that when you going like ever since right-wing media became enormous in roughly like 2012 or so, Republicans, when you ask them if the economy, how is it going with the economy? They say it sucks. It's horrible. It's a depression if a Democrat is the president.
Yeah.
And that's irrespective of how it's going. You could have 10% GDP growth and 1% unemployment, and they would say it was a depression.
Yes.
And in fact, they did do that. We know for a fact that after Obama was reelected, the economy was going great. It's going fantastic. But Republicans said it was horrible, the worst ever. And we're seeing that over again now with Joe Biden. And this is just purely a repetition of the message. So they all believe it. And then that sort of is a infectious belief to people who don't know anything. Like if your apolitical person, their right-wing neighbor tells them, we're in a depression right now. We're in a recession right now. What do they know to say otherwise? And who have they heard to tell them that that's not true? No.
Yep.
They believe it.
Yeah.
And that's why we are where we are with the economy. But, you know, like your average economist, they're like, oh, gosh, that just must be inflation. That's all it is. And it's like, you guys haven't looked at any actual polling other than the usual ones you look at. And that's
and just to reiterate how powerful the effect that you're describing is. And I do this every transition, like every time the party switches in the White House, because the Gallup data goes back forever. So you can do it for a long time. It's much stronger of an effect in the polarized era, but it's always been there. You have outgoing Republican Trump, right? In December, November of the election year, you have an incoming Joe Biden. When you look at that 4 months of Gallup data, almost immediately upon the inaugural, you will see the Republicans that thought the economy was wonderful under Trump suddenly drop down to 10%. And it inverts completely, right? Because Democrats are less tribal, so they'll be more honest. Yeah. But there's still a partisan thing to it. And so Trump is in office. The economy's awful. Trump's out of office, even though we're in a pandemic. Democrats are much more likely to say the economy was good even before it actually became good again, right? So partisan, when I talk about partisanship and my frustration and my motivation to even become this person that I am today, it's because it is so powerful. And yet we ignore it in almost all of our analysis. We don't understand. Like I did a survey once at the Wasson Center, my polling firm. I wanted to see like, okay, since people don't know anything, they know maybe the Republicans and Democrats, the position on guns, on abortion. But beyond that, not really, right? So I ran some policy questions by voters in an experimental survey design where I would rotate the party proposing the policy to show people when you look at how Republicans act for a policy proposal, if they're told it's a Republican that wants to do it, massive support. But if the same policy description is assigned to a Democrat, collapse. I mean, and not just little changes, 5, 10, I'm talking 40 point movement on that. Okay. And so it really is completely underestimated and understood how much partisanship matters. And in a modern public mass opinion, what we're seeing in a lot of survey data now that this didn't used to be so much of an issue is basically a measure of latent partisanship. So you have the partisans and then you have the leaners that are basically closet partisans. And really, if you want to know how the public
partisans in denial.
Right. And so if you really want to know, like, not necessarily how the public is feeling, but how like the top of mind awareness narrative in the independent bucket is, you have to suss out those leaners from your independents and sample enough that you can look at pure independents only. And that's where you can see things like how successful Republicans have been defining Biden as senile and having dementia, when we all know that Donald Trump has much worse mental acumen problems.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. One of the other things that I think a lot of people who do left-leaning politics is that they don't understand that the political viewpoints of people that they're more of an XY graph rather than a left to right graph. And once you have that realization, I think that you understand, like when you look at, and on the screen, we've got a graph for those who are listening, you want to check the show notes to see the graph. But basically, like libertarianism can be perceived as both left and right. Because most people, they don't really have a sound conception of, well, the government should spend more on this five things and not on these, and less on these five things. People don't think in those terms. They think in terms of what do I prioritize, society or the individual, or do I prioritize reason or tradition? And so, and it's relevant to this discussion because I think there are a lot of people out there who are, they have a libertarian standpoint. And we've seen during the Trump years that a lot of libertarians have come home to the right wing, whereas before they have maybe a more secular outlook. They're not religious fundamentalists. So they saw the Republican Party as disgusting, full of theocrats. But then under, like with the rise of Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren, AOC, the Democratic Party is kind of relearning its former economic populism that it had for a long time. And these Republicans these libertarians, they're disgusted at that because in their viewpoint, everything should be about the individual. And so in their case, if the party that's saying less regulations and less lower taxes, then they're going to go for that. And that's why I think the news media is filled with people like this, the mainstream yes. media. That, you know, they thought the rich Christian right was gross, but now they're saying, oh, their Democratic Party has become too extreme. They're just out of control. What's wrong with them? Well, they're a bunch of communist wokesters.
Well, keep in mind, I mean, we're talking about a branding operation of now steady for 14 years, 2010 on, that have been defining, making sure to elevate the squad, right? I mean, so let's look at this thing, right? I study stuff in quantitative form, and we have great measurements of polarization, and we can see which party has an extremism problem. The Democrat, every party is going to have a base of ideologues that are nuts, okay? But the question is about proportion, how much proportional control.
And how much power do they have?
Yeah, do those bases have? And so when you look at the Democrats, right, they've got the squad and the Hamas 11, right? But it's 11 people, dude, 11. And they don't have any committee chairmanships and they don't control anything. And they certainly aren't running the RNC, the DNC, and they don't have a president in the White House. I mean, they're basically neutered and the Democratic Party remains pretty much where it's been the last 20 years, which is predominantly dominated by moderates. Okay. It's a 70% moderate party, a 30% ideological liberal party. And on the other side, 10 years ago, this was the truth for the Republican Party, 70% establishment Republican, 30% Tea Party base, right? When that began in 2010. And what has been so remarkable as a political scientist is to see that invert, okay? And it's happening only on that one side right now, where it's actually the base that's the majority population, the 75% of the Republican Party that's pro-Trump, pro-MAGA, pro-Christo-fascism, whatever it is, it dwarfs the Mitch McConnell part of the party now. And that's the big difference. But the image, it's very easy to paint. I mean, that's why it's frustrating, right? I have had to write a whole book. Like, how can Democrats let themselves be defined by 10 people that have no power, where the Republican Party has all these extremists in charge, and we're not even telling people, right? Like we're not defining them around these crazy people, and these crazy people are actually running the ship, right? So we,
yeah, you know, Mike Johnson, Donald Trump.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly right. And it is just a mathematical fact. Polarization is asymmetrical. Democrats are less polarized both in the mass public and in voter member of Congress behavior. And at the end of the day, we're now up against a real radicalized party in the Republican Party. These are people that are living in a world in which some truths are self-evident. Number one, Joe Biden stole the election and is illegitimate. Number two, the COVID vaccine is more deadly than COVID. Okay. Number three, Donald Trump is an innocent man who's never done anything wrong, right? Those things sound loony, okay? But that is the truth that many millions of Americans are living in day to day. And that's why we're under this existential threat level in 2024.
Yeah. But what's terrible is that the vast majority of Americans don't have those opinions, but almost all of that majority doesn't understand that Republicans believe those things.
That's right.
Because if they did, they would be extremely
concerned. And we know it because we told people in two states in 2022, in Arizona and in Michigan, we told people what was happening with the modern Republican Party and made them see. And they rejected them. I mean, by September, it was clear that Michigan was uncompetitive for Republicans in that gubernatorial race, right? So it's clear to me, like, once people find out about, but right now, most people who are going to go cast an R ballot in 2024, all they know about Republicans, honest to God, it's low taxes. They have impressions. Low taxes, good for the economy, good on national defense. We both know that that's not the case for the last 20 years. And yet those images, those issue ownership effects are still very profound in data. They're going to remain so until we rebrand the Republican Party and define it as an extremist cult.
Yeah. Now, I'm glad you mentioned the idea of issue ownership, because that is something that you do talk quite a bit about in the book. And it fits into the larger point that for most people, they don't have a coherent idea about what the parties think about things. And even under the huge propaganda operation of Republicans telling them lies about what Democrats think, they still, all that the people who are kind of, who were, are, will vote for Republicans, all they know is that the Democrats are extreme on that issue. They don't actually know what even an exaggerated version of what Democrats think. They don't know it. All they know is Democrats are extreme on education. Democrats are extreme on X. And that's all they know. And I think anybody who has a MAGA relative or a Republican in denial relative or friend, like, that's all they really know to say to you about anything, that Democrats are godless, communist, transgender, Black people radicals or Black radicals. That's all Democrats are. And if you don't, and again, because Democratic leaders, they know that that's an absurdly stupid idea in its lies. It is outright lies. They think, and you talk about this, that this idea, Democrats are obsessed with the idea, well, the American people will figure that out.
Right.
But will they figure that out?
No. No, they will not, right? That's the whole, like, if you had to sum up what the book is about, that's what it's about, right? No, they will not figure it out. American people are plenty smart, like all civilized Western democracies living through the greatest period of human development ever, okay? There's no human that has ever walked the earth that is more fortunate than you living in the 21st century. We can grow new livers out of pig kidneys and right? Like, humanity is peak freedom, peak individual liberty. Like, libertarian friends, I have to tell you, the entire right era of individual rights is a liberal concept. It comes from the liberals, not from the Republicans. And yet no one knows that, right? No one understands that we're living through this incredible time period of massive calories, massive, people used to starve to death, dude, in the West, like, all the time, millions. And it's so different now. And we don't do a good job of telling that story and making sure that people understand that how benefited they are from to be alive right now and be living in America, but that it's all very, very new. Very, very new. I'm the first generation as a woman born in 1977 that was born with actual legal equality. Okay. Because prior to that, women couldn't maybe get a credit card. They couldn't do bank loans. They couldn't get birth control in the 60s. You couldn't even get it as a married couple until the Griswold decision said that actually it's a privacy matter and people should be able to make their own decisions. So if you're big into individual rights and liberty, I'm telling you, you're looking at the wrong party if you're thinking about voting for Republicans.
Yeah, no, definitely true. And one of the other things as a co-host of a comedy news panel show, I certainly agree with you. You talk about the idea, the importance of mockery as a political strategy. So why do you think that is so important?
Yeah, so I was greatly concerned heading into this new Congress because I knew that they were going to weaponize the government and use the committee process to try to politically damage Biden and other Democrats. And the media has always assisted them every time, like no collusion memo or Benghazi and butter emails or whatever, right? The media will treat things that are illegitimate as legitimate. And once you do so, you have legitimized it. CRT is a case in point of that. The Democrats kept explaining how it's this and that, and it's a legal theory and not about, it's not even in the schools. Now you've legitimated the stupid rando thing that Chris Rufo basically steals from some freak's PowerPoint, right? Like, so mocking is about preventing the legitimization of the false premise of their bullshit investigation. And it's so critical to our survival because when we meet their crazy with a factual rebuttal, all we have done is legitimated the crazy. And so mocking the crazy is a way of making people see it, number one. But number two, it's about making people feel like, I don't want to be with stupid, right? So if we're making fun of them and highlighting how ridiculously stupid they are, it's much more likely that people are going to be like, oh, that's crazy. They're crazy people. Instead of trying to define why it's wrong.
Yeah, and the reason for that is that you can't fact check your way out of delusions. Like, if you disagree with that, go try to have an argument with the schizophrenic about their hallucinations, whether
exactly. No, it's exactly right. And so when you look at the Democrats on the House Oversight Committee have been just tremendous at this, right? Every committee hearing that they've had, they have strategically mocked the Republicans and prevented them from painting a false narrative about what is a delusion. It is a delusion to argue that Joe Biden was selling foreign interference with Hunter Biden. Okay. And the way to deal with that is to make sure people see it as ridiculous.
Yeah. And when you do that, it irritates the hell out of them.
Yes, it does.
And you certainly see that in those hearings. Are constantly losing their minds when they're fact checked like that. Mocked and fact checked.
Yeah, they're so used to us swinging on their pitch, right? So it surprised them that they couldn't get the media to legitimate these Hunter Biden allegations, okay? It surprised them that Democrats didn't come in and grill the witnesses and da-da-da-da-da and accept the premise, the false premise, that instead they use their committee hearing time as a stage, right? And they made their strategic mocking the point of the coverage. And it's been very helpful, though we've got lots of room to improve. There are signs of improvement, both on the electioneering end, my work and others on Team Reform pushing these reforms, because I'm certainly not alone. And in the terms of media, being at least a little bit more wary of carrying the Republican water when they serve them up something. But we'll see how this HER memo continues to be covered. It was last night was a real backslide, in my opinion. The media jumped right on it and treated it as a legitimate conclusion and not a political document designed to get them to say that Joe Biden's senile.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think one of the other things that the right wing is very good at is pushing, and you do talk about this also, that pushing a simple message. So Republicans don't run on their agenda. They don't actually tell you what they want to do, except for maybe on immigration. That's right. At this point, that's all they will tell you about what they will do. On every other issue, They don't ever talk about it. They don't talk about what they want to do with taxes. They don't talk about what they want to do on regulation. They don't talk about spending. They don't talk about anything else except for immigration. And so it makes it easy if for people who are really into that issue to be really motivated to support them. But it also makes it so that the voters, that they don't have to debate their positions because nobody even knows about them.
Exactly.
So because, and so they have no, so like there's this idea in warfare of the idea of an attack surface. And when you, that you want to have as small of a, from an aerial bombardment, you want to have as small of a surface possible to be hit. And that's basically the core strategy of Republican politics, is to minimize all attack surfaces of their own and then maximize the attack surfaces of Democrats.
And they're so
they're
good
remarkably
at it.
Successful at it.
Yeah, and we have to be too. So like to me, nothing frustrates me more than, well, we're Democrats, we just can't do that. No bullshit, we can, we must, and we will. Right? And if we don't, we're going to be looking at some serious hurt for especially brown people in this country. The Republican Party has been very clear that they're coming for communities of color day one. They're talking about mass deportations and roundups. And folks, there's no way you do that without really trampling on the rights of Latino Americans. Many, many U.S. citizens and people who have legal entry are going to be terrorized if we do this, if we let this happen. So it's now or never. When Republicans go low, we got to hit them where it hurts.
All right. Well, there you go. You wrapped that up very nicely there, Rachel.
Thought you'd appreciate that.
All right. Well, so we've been talking today with Rachel Bidikoff. Bidikoffer. I have to do that again. So
yeah.
God, I always, it's because you only have one F in there. It just makes me.
It's a horrible name. I mean, it is. Now I've made it famous so I can never get rid of it. That sucks.
Okay. I have to do that again here. So we've been talking today with Rachel Bidikoffer, and she's the author of the book Hit 'Em Where It Hurts. And you can get that everywhere now on the internet, wherever you want to, including bad places like Amazon, but other places that are
good. And Audible, where if you really like my cackle, you can listen to the Audible. I recorded it myself.
Okay, there you go. And then you are also on various social platforms at Rachel Bidikoffer. That is with one F for those who are listening. And so I encourage everybody to check you out over there. And then you also have a podcast and Substack called The Cycle. So people can check that out as well. So, all right. Thanks for being here today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Matthew.
So that is the program for today. I appreciate everybody for joining us for the conversation. And of course, you can always get more. If you go to theoryofchange.show, you can get the full episode archive with the video, audio, and transcript of all the episodes. And if you are a paid subscribing member, you get complete unlimited access. And you can sign up on either Substack or on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/discoverflux, you can subscribe that way if you don't like Substack. And then, of course, I encourage everybody to go over to flux.community, where this show is part of the Flux Network, and we have several different podcasts and articles to check out about politics, religion, media, and society, and how they all intersect and help get this. Let's do that again. And you can go to flux.community to get more podcasts and articles about politics, religion, media, and society, and how they all intersect. And we need to band together people who are opposing fascism in this country. And I appreciate everybody who is supporting the show. If you can't support financially through a subscription, just tell your friends or family about it. And I really appreciate that. And if you can leave a written review on Apple Podcasts in particular, that is super, super helpful. I really do appreciate those. Thank you very much.